All right, what an interesting passage. What are we going to make of this today? Okay, well, I wonder if anyone else can relate to that feeling that I get, at least, when I'm in the middle of a shopping center, I'm casually getting from A to B, and I look up, and what do I see? I see those people standing at their booths, just waiting for you to walk past, ready to pounce, come out and interrupt you to try and have a conversation with you about this or that. And I don't know about you, but when I see those people, it fills me with dread because I know they're going to want to talk to me. So much so that I've been trying out a few different strategies. You know, there's the strategy where you wait for a large group to go by and you just sneak in the back and walk past so that no one will talk to you. There's another one where you time your run, you wait for the person at the booth to just look the other way and then you scoot past. You know, I've seen some of these strategies here this morning as well, just at the front, people walking in. I mean, there's also, you know, walking right up at the edge of the shopping centre. Do you know who I'm talking about? I'm talking about those people at the booths. They're always at a booth and they're trying to sell you on this, on that. And, you know, sometimes it's for something worthwhile. Sometimes it's for paintballs. Who knows? But the point is they want you to subscribe. They want you to put your email down. You know, it's just so hard these days to get out and about without, you know, dishing out your email everywhere you go. Just recently, not long ago, I was shopping for Christmas present. And I found myself in a tea shop. Not my usual environment, believe me. But there I was, and I was buying some fancy tea. And at the counter, I asked the lady, oh, can you just wrap that up for me? It's a Christmas gift. And she said, yeah, sure, it'll just be $5. And I thought, oh, okay. But then she said, you know what? It's free for members. All you got to do is just dish out that email. And sure enough, 5 minutes later, they had my email address, and I had a nicely wrapped Christmas present. Ever since, I've been getting the occasional email promoting new wellness teas or pumping pomegranate. You know. But it's not just tea shops. Almost everywhere you go these days, people seem angled to get you to subscribe or to follow. That is, put yourself on a mailing list and get regular updates and marketing, all of that. You know, some, as I said, not all of it's bad. Many of the voices bidding for us to follow are worth listening to. But, you know, not all of them are. And the question is, how do we know whom we should follow? Who do we subscribe to? It's not always obvious. And I think there's, you know, sometimes it doesn't really matter, but sometimes it's really significant. I think about the story of Lindy Chamberlain. That might be a familiar name to you if you're around in the 80s. You probably saw the story of the Chamberlains unfold in the news. If you're not familiar with it, essentially what happened was that in 1980, Lindy Chamberlain and her then husband were out camping near Uluru when, on that trip, their two-month-old went missing, her body never to be found. And Lindy, the mother, reported to the police that a dingo had taken her baby. But the police, finding that far-fetched, proceeded with the prosecution, and eventually she was convicted for murder of her two-month-old daughter. However, 6 years later, pieces of Azaria's clothing were found in various dingo lairs, and fast forward to 2012, 22 years after the original incident, and a coroner found that Azaria had been taken and killed by a dingo. You know, it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to believe Lindy's innocence, but at the time, I suspect it would have been difficult to assert any opinion with certainty. I mean, no doubt there would have been a number of theories floating around depending on whom you listened to, and I think the popular opinion at the time, you can correct me, I wasn't actually around. but I think the popular opinion at the time promulgated by the media was that Lindy was guilty. And yet, with the benefit of more recent evidence and inquiries, she's been vindicated. So I think this shows us, it helps demonstrate for us the importance of who we listen to. It's a story, it's a classic example of people getting it wrong and how we can follow the wrong source to an unfounded position. Okay, well, as Christians, we might say, well, who do we follow? There's an obvious answer to that, and it goes without saying that we follow Jesus. And I'm not really here to convince you that that's what Christians do. What I want to look at, though, in chapter 8 of Matthew is, what does that really mean? What can we learn from Matthew 8 about what it means to really follow Jesus? See, I think that this chapter shows us how Jesus demands a different kind of following, one that turns the usual paradigm upside down. So with that in mind, let's jump into the passage, Matthew 8, 18-34. I'd ask if you could read along with me, and we're going to look at the question of how do we follow Jesus. So let's jump right in at verse 18, and it goes like this. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Now, what's interesting about this point right here is that this is a teacher of the law. It's not a lawyer. It's not someone in the legal system per se. It's a teacher of the religious law of the time. It was a scribe, someone who was renowned for their knowledge of the scriptures. And what's interesting here is that it's not just anyone volunteering to be a follower of Jesus. It's a scribe, and throughout the Gospels, the scribes and Jesus haven't always seen eye to eye. Usually, often the scribes and Jesus had a tenuous relationship, the scribes trying to catch Jesus out on this, on that, asking tricky questions. So it's interesting, isn't it, that here the scribe is saying, "Jesus, I will follow you wherever you go." You might think, well, if Jesus had this relationship with the scribe so far, and here's a scribe actually willing to get on board with what he's going on about, you would have thought that Jesus would respond positively, say, "Great, sign up. Where's your email address? We'll get you on their mailing list," right? It's not what he says, is it? Let's look in verse 20. Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." It's a bit cryptic here, but I think Jesus sees what's really going on in this man's heart, that this scribe didn't have a genuine desire for ministry or to truly follow Jesus, but rather he was caught up in the excitement aspect of what was going on. So did you notice in verse 18 what it says? It says the crowds were increasing. See, crowds are attractive. There's something drawing about the momentum, excitement, and sensationalism of being in a crowd. There's something even more attractive about being at the center of a crowd, perhaps to even be one of the leaders of the crowd. The point here is that it's easy to say to Jesus, "Lord, I will follow you wherever you go," when in your mind, Jesus is going with the crowd. Wherever he's going, there's going to be a crowd. But it's not the case, is it? Jesus says to him, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." So Jesus was looking like he was going to be the next big hit. And you'll notice Jesus doesn't say he didn't want the scribe to follow him, but he reminds him there's a cost. He's saying, this may look like a sweet deal right now, but following me isn't about the glamour. I mean, Jesus is already taking things in a hard direction. He's warning the scribe that following is not going to be comfortable or easy. We're not used to this, are we? This kind of following. Usually, you know, these days we only find out about the DAGs, the downsides of something, after we've already signed up. But Jesus isn't about padding up a crowd to make a name for himself. And there's something reassuring about this. You know, if Jesus is honest about what it costs, I think what it says to us is that we can believe him when he says when he makes promises about what it means to follow him. So it gives added authenticity to when Jesus says, "It is finished," a final victory statement over sin and death. It adds authenticity to when Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." But when he says, "Do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing?" See, the way Jesus gathers followers shows us how these statements that Jesus made throughout his lifetime, as well as many others, they're not sugar-coated, are they? They're not incentives to bluff people into following him. I mean, just look at verse 18. What does it say? The crowds were increasing. And how does Jesus respond to that? He says, "Let's get a boat. Let's go to the other side." It doesn't make sense if Jesus is all about gathering as much influence as possible for him to just simply amass a crowd and leave, or to turn away a scribe. Instead, what we see is Jesus wanting genuine relationships with his followers, wanting genuine a genuine following. And that adds authenticity to what Jesus says. Let's jump into the passage again. In verse 21, another disciple comes and says to Jesus, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." Now, I always found this passage a little bit uncomfortable here. In the first reading, you might think that what he's saying is, "Lord, my dad's really sick, or maybe he's just passed away. Let me go and sort out the funeral arrangements, and then I'll come and follow you." And but that's the way we might read that from our, the way we understand the language. But what you need to know about this comment is that it's very unlikely that this man's father is actually dead. He's probably not even close to death. It was Jewish tradition back then that if someone died, they would be buried within 24 hours. So the likelihood of this guy following Jesus around when his father's just died seems very unlikely. Instead, what this man's essentially saying is that he wants to follow Jesus, but just not now. It's an idiomatic way. "Let me bury my father" was an idiomatic way of saying, I'm committed to this and that right now. I've got some family duties going on, but when life's a little more settled down, then I'll follow you. I think this is a little more akin to the kind of following we're used to today. Today, when someone says they'll follow something, what they generally mean is, I'm interested in this or that, but, at the moment it doesn't serve me, I'm out. If it doesn't fit into my life, it's either going to sit on the shelf or it's not even on the agenda anymore. So, we also talk about, subscriptions in a similar way that we think about following things. For example, we might go for Netflix over Stan or subscribe to a newspaper online. If we read something we don't like, or, Netflix runs out of interesting content, we unsubscribe. So imagine the conversations. "Oh yeah, do you follow the Brisbane Lions?" "Oh, I used to, but not since their massive losing streak." Where's the loyalty? Or maybe the conversation is, "Oh, do you follow this person's social media?" Maybe, "Do you follow Trump on Twitter?" It's like, "Oh, nah, yeah, used to, but then there was too many rants going on, so I unfollowed them." Or, maybe it's more of a conversation like this. "Do you subscribe to this newspaper, online newspaper?" It's like, "Yeah, I do, but, I pick and choose what I believe. Sometimes you've got to take it with a grain of salt." These are all types of following that I think we're used to, but there are also types of following that are fundamentally to the following that Jesus asks of us. See, we're used to following things that fit into our lives but demand no real change. We subscribe to what props up our ready-made routines rather than what threatens to undermine them. But truly following Jesus means fitting into his plans, not the other way around. So let's have a brief recap. Disciple comes and says, "Let me bury my father. That is, Lord, first let me go and tend to this and that, then I'll follow you." And Jesus' response cuts through like a knife. He says in verse 22, "Follow me and let the dead bury the dead." So again, this isn't Jesus saying you can't go to your father's funeral. The Jews did that on the same day. Rather, it's Jesus saying, following me is to be concerned with the spiritual things over and above the things of this world. Following me is life. Recently this passage has spoken to me quite significantly. For some time, I felt God nudging me that I needed to go get some further training at Bible college. And there's just never been a good time. I've always said to myself, I'll go next year, I'll go next semester. I'm having a baby this semester, we'll just put it off. So you can see that how Matthew chapter 8 hit me like a sledgehammer. Here's a disciple putting into words what was more or less the way I'd been following Jesus. "God, I'm willing. I'll go to college eventually, but first, let me take care of this and that." For me, it wasn't, necessarily family duties. It was more, pursuing a career in software development. I've been working as a developer for the last few months or so, and I love it. I love building things. My heart was saying, "God, I'm willing to follow you. Just let me have this for a while. Let me wrap up these projects, then I'll go to college." Does this sound familiar? My heart was saying, "Let me bury my father and then I'll follow you." Well, how does Jesus respond to that? He says, "Let the dead bury the dead." And I had a moment of stark realization reading that I needed to act on what God was prompting me to do. It didn't make sense. I thought, you know, this is fresh, guys. I thought, you know, there's no way. Semester one starts next week. I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll call up QTC. I'll call up the college and find out. And, you know, sure enough, they said, get your forms in now and we'll start you on Tuesday. So that's what's happening, people. The point is, we can't expect to follow Jesus the same way we follow tennis or we follow a sport or a news outlet. See, if following Jesus truly means to be clawed back from the clutches of sin and shame, to be revitalized from death to life, to walk alongside the Creator, then it should not surprise us that following Jesus also involves relinquishing our claim over our lives and the comparatively short-sighted ambitions to which we cling. Why does it surprise us that Jesus wants everything? And following Jesus is about going all in and trusting Him. All right, let's look back at the passage. We're going to dive back in at verse 23. We're going to go all the way to 34. Sorry. It reads like this. Then Jesus got onto a boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're going to drown. To which he replied, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? Actually, I've often wondered about this. Was this a statement, you know, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? Or was it more, you know, wanting to shake these disciples, going, you little faith, why are you so afraid? It's not really clear. You can have your own opinion there. But the point is that what Jesus does, he acts. He gets up and he rebuked the winds and the waves and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, what kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him. Verse 28. When he arrived at the other side of the region of the Gadarenes, I think that is it, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. What do you want with us, Son of God? They shouted. Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time? Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, if you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs. He said to them, go. So they came out, went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region. What do we make of this? So here Jesus cameos in two distinct but similar, I'd say, displays of power and authority. In the first, Jesus commands the winds and the waves. Picture the scenario here. The disciples, experienced fishermen, are out on the water when the weather gets so bad that even these experienced fishermen are fearful of their lives. And yet what is Jesus doing? He's asleep. He's not worried. It almost seems like a reference back to his statement to the scribe that not even the Son of Man has a place to lay his head, because lo and behold, there Jesus is, finding sleep on a boat, not the most comfortable of places. Well, the disciples are afraid, so they wake Jesus up. I find it interesting that at least on some level, the disciples had the right instincts here to seek help from Jesus. And in the midst of the storm, Jesus says to the waves and the wind, he rebukes them and says, be still. And they obey. Now, for those of us who've grown up in a Christian environment and have regularly attended church, I imagine it's pretty easy to read through this passage through the same foggy lens we always have. You know, it's easy to overlook the sheer miracle of what's going on here. That the storm is so bad it makes the disciples fearful, and at a word, Jesus commands the storm, be still. And immediately it's quiet. It doesn't work when I talk to the storm outside. I can shout all I want. They don't obey me. The wind and the waves don't respond to me. But to Jesus, they do. Because he has power and authority over the winds and the waves. There you go. When we read this passage, what more of a clear picture do you need of Jesus' divinity, power, authority? Jesus' authority over the natural world is on display. But it doesn't stop there. See, the story continues. The whole posse goes over to the other side of the lake, where two demon-possessed men come out of a tomb to meet Jesus. Now, these are men whose violence had become infamous, such that no one could pass through the area. Nonetheless, what does Jesus do? He says, "Go," to which the demons leave the men, rush into a herd of pigs, and the pigs rush down the steep bank where they drown. So there must be some commotion involved here. I don't think it was a quiet confrontation. I suspect this is, you know, a raucous big affair going on, such that the men run off to the town to report it, and the whole town comes out to meet Jesus. What do we make of this? Now, I have a lot of questions for Jesus when I pass away about it in particular, but I think there's one thing that's impossible to miss about this passage. Not only does Jesus have authority over the natural world, but he has authority over demons. Jesus has authority over the spiritual world as well. And the point I want to draw from this part of the passage is this: Jesus is worthy to be followed. See, the struggle to do what we need to do, which we see in part one, that is, genuinely follow Jesus, to count the cost, be willing to relinquish the plans we have for our own lives, the struggle we have to do this is made possible because Jesus is worthy. You know, he's more powerful than the wind and the waves. He's above demonic forces. Jesus is powerful to save. You know, suddenly the cost doesn't seem so great when you get a glimpse of who Jesus truly is. All right, well, I'm here today with my very pregnant wife. You've probably seen her around. She's the one with that. Although there may be a few of those around. Anyway, and we're about to have our second son. And it's with some amount of experience that I want to tell you this morning that there are some really compelling reasons not to have a baby. Number one, they're expensive, you know. I'm suspecting that only increases as they get older, when they can start asking for more and more expensive things. Number two, they ruin your sleep. I thought I used to be able to cope on little sleep, and, you know, this is proving me wrong. Number three, they can't change their own nappy. That's on you as a parent. You know, I can go on, they have tantrums to throw, they have tears to cry, there will be sleepless nights. You know, I was very aware of these things leading up to Ash's birth, and you wonder, you know, with reasons as compelling as this, why does anyone have children? but I want to tell you, all of those reasons just melted. They faded away when I got a chance to get a glimpse of who Asher was. When I had a chance to meet him and hold him, suddenly it didn't matter anymore. You know, following Jesus is like that. You might have all the reasons up your sleeve why you shouldn't follow him, or why you shouldn't follow him in the way he wants you to follow. You might, you know, he might lead you through some difficult circumstances, sure. You might have to face a storm or two along the journey. Maybe it means something you'll have to let go of, but I want to tell you, all of these reasons melt to nothing when you see a glimpse of who Jesus truly is. You know, it's not just that he has power over the wind and the waves and demons, but when you see Jesus and you see his heart, you see that he has a heart for the lost. He has a desire to know you. You know, one example of this for me where I think I really am impacted by a glimpse of Jesus' heart is when he's on the cross in John chapter 9. He's being crucified, and yet even in his suffering he looks down and he sees his mother, and he says to his mother, who must have been feeling such anguish, you think about it, she's there standing looking up at her son dying on a cross. You know, parents shouldn't bury their own children. But anyway, Jesus looks down and he sees his mother And even in his suffering, he says to her, "Behold your son." And he says to his disciple whom he loved, "Behold your mother." It's another passage we can gloss over, but think about it. Jesus is arranging for his disciple to look after his mother. It's another example of Jesus showing compassion, expressing his love for people, even in his suffering. We see a glimpse of Jesus here, that his heart is for you. So what's your response going to be to Jesus? You know, perhaps as we've looked through this passage, you might identify with some of the characters here. I know for me, it was definitely with the second disciple. I was willing, you know, to follow, to listen, but you know, only maybe so far as it would fit into my plans. Maybe you identify the scribe, you're enthusiastic in the moment, but only really at a surface level. And while things are exciting, while there's some momentum in the crowd, maybe you're like one of the disciples on the boat, you're caught up in the middle of a storm. Or maybe, sadly, you're like the members of the town. Think about what they did. They heard of what Jesus did with the demon-possessed man, and they came out and they pleaded with him to leave. What's your response going to be to Jesus? And as difficult as you might find it to make to follow him, if you find yourself in the tension of finding it difficult to give up something or maybe to count the cost, well, what I want to do is point you to Jesus. Look at who he is. And pray to him, ask him, "Lord, would you show me a glimpse of yourself? Show me your heart." Because following Jesus is worthwhile. He is worthy to be followed. All right, let me pray. Dear Heavenly Father, I ask that you would give us a newfound understanding of your word, that some of these passages, which we may or may not have read many times or heard on many occasions, Lord, would you give us a newfound understanding of what it means to follow you? Lord, it's not always easy to do that. We understand that following you will lead us through a path of uncertainty, and there may be storms along the way, but God, we ask that you would help us to see who you are, the value of who you are and your heart for us. God, there is a great picture in history of your heart for us as Jesus died on the cross. And God, we want to thank you for your willingness to come down and meet us in our need. So God, bless us now. Help us to live out what we might mentally decide to do. And Lord, go with us now in your Holy Spirit. We pray in your mighty name. Amen.